Good evening, everyone. Thank you, David. I think I was just saying to David, there was so much stuff in what you said, and he told me it normally takes him 50 minutes to deliver that and did it in about 22. So that was double the speed of normal. So much to get your head round. And there's loads of brilliant questions, which I think in some senses give you a chance, David, to kind of run back on things and say a little bit more, and in other senses move us on. But I hope we deal with most people's questions, but you'll understand that some of you asked exactly the same thing as some of the others of you in slightly different words. So I hope everybody feels their subjects are covered. And there's a whole load of questions here, David, about the Bible to start with, and Jesus. And I suppose this one sums it all up. How does one deal with Jesus? Because we got to take Jesus seriously. We're Jesus followers. How does one deal with Jesus eating fish and telling the disciples where to catch them?
Yeah, so this is a really important issue to address, and I think it's really crucial to be engaging with these questions of Jesus' example in his own eating practice and working out what we make of that. And there's a few things I'd want to say about our engagement with our understanding of Jesus and his example for Christians. First of all, I think we have read out of the New Testament a lot of times when Jesus is assuming an engagement with the wider creaturely world in his ministry. So we ignore the teachings in the Sermon on the Mount when he presents birds of the air and lilies of the field as models for discipleship. We ignore it when he reminds his audience, when he's trying to reassure fearful disciples, he says, look, you know that not a single sparrow falls apart from your Father. And then he goes on, and this is the bit we kind of tend to focus on. The second half of that, don't be afraid, you're worth more than many sparrows. But that reassurance to his disciples only works on the basis of a shared understanding of Jesus and his audience that God cares for every single living creature, even the creatures we are inclined to discount like sparrows. So a radical concern for each creature is the foundation of Jesus' reassurance to his disciples. So we need to pay attention to that as a fundamental foundation of how we understand Jesus' engagement with the creatures that he has to do with. And then we need to attend to the meaning of Jesus' own practice. Now, most of what I've been talking this evening in the raising of animals is the way in which fairly recently we've massively changed the way we raise animals. So in the last 70 years, we've invented this radically novel practice of industrialized animal agriculture, reshaped the bodies of animals, subjected them to conditions that have made their products cheaper than ever before. And so the first thing I want to say in relation to Jesus' example is Jesus' eating is of animals is not the same as our eating of animals. So meat eating was much less common, much less frequent. Animals were not treated in the same way. And so our own context is very different. And so for me, I would want to point to many cases where Jesus should be an example for us in radical love of the other, neighbor love and so on, self-sacrifice. But there's some aspects of Jesus' ministry that we shouldn't take and directly apply to our context. So according to scripture, Jesus picked 12 male disciples. Now, in our context, we need a vision of Christian leadership, as far as I'm concerned, that is radically inclusive of other genders. And so there are some aspects of Jesus' practice where we ought to be recognizing a difference in context between him and us. And for me, the consumption of animals is one of those places. So it doesn't seem a big problem for me that Jesus was eating fish with his disciples in those times, because those weren't the same fish. It does make it hard to make an argument that that Christianity has always been a religion about a sort of absolute vegan demand. I grant you that, and that's not the case I've made to you this evening. The primary argument I'm trying to make in relation to fellow Christians is that paying attention to the way in which animals are raised at the moment gives us very serious reasons for reducing consumption and thinking about the welfare of animals that we're treating. And veganism is one important response to that context.
And so there's a clear question here. I think you've in some ways answered this, but to just nail it, someone's asked, so therefore, is it wrong? Is it always wrong to eat meat? And other people have pointed out, it wasn't just fish that Jesus was eating, but as part of his Jewish tradition, the Passover, lamb, etc., etc. So are you saying now that it's always wrong?
No. And this is really important too. So there are many contexts where there is very little choice about how people are going to survive from day to day. If you look at Siberian pastoralist reindeer farmers, they're following reindeer herds around, and there is very little alternative sources of nutrition. It would be extraordinary for me to march into that context and say, oh no, you're doing this all wrong. In many African contexts, again, pastoralist farmers are making a living and sustaining families through their absolute dependence on the animals in their care. And again, I'm not going to march in as a white Western vegan and tell them that they're wrong. I want us to be paying attention to the context where we find ourselves and where we've got choices of either sustaining ourselves through the killing of other animals or with all the implications for environmental and human well-being that that creates, or making choices to move towards a plant-based diet. Seems to me a really obvious responsibility on us to do that. But that doesn't mean that this is historically or even in the present an absolute for all Christians.
So I'd just like to hand this over to you now, because David, you made a clear distinction. How do you feel about this? So a kind of sense of relativity that David's introduced here.
Two things related to this. One, in Genesis chapter 1, it indicates that veganism is God's first choice and ideal. Now, in some way, which we're not going to settle here, things didn't work out as God had intended. And we know in Isaiah there's the picture of a reconciled creation, and also things like the creation being redeemed. So I just wanted to point out that veganism is God's ideal, whatever else has happened since. The other thing I just wanted to say, in case it's helpful, sometimes we might get other Christians say, oh, God gave us permission, and you're turning down a gift of God. I've had that said to me on odd occasions. But I think there's chapter 1 of Daniel is quite important, because when he was in a foreign land and the food was being offered to idols, the meat was being offered to idols, he refused to eat it because it wasn't... He did this to honour God, because the meat being offered to him was not appropriate due to the God's laws as he understood them in the Old Covenant. Now, I think we can transfer that into the New Covenant era in which we are, that what might have been appropriate, there are good reasons which honour God to be vegetarian today, and it is not a case of turning down a gift, but honouring God by the New Covenant of compassion, mercy, and so on.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So another way of thinking about veganism in a Christian context is as witness to an inbreaking reign of God. So that we're heir to biblical texts which think about God's original and final intention for peace, radical peace between creatures. No more an end to predation, an end to killing, an end to suffering, an end to this groaning of creation. And insofar as we're able, through our own dietary practice, I think there's a small way in which we can witness to that inbreaking, peaceable reign of God through making decisions about what we eat.
Another question down here.
Thank you. I found the whole thing really inspiring. It's brilliant. Thank you. I do also want to say a difficulty I have, obviously not in other contexts where meat and fish eating and animal farming is necessary for survival. We are, after all, animals like all animals and do what we do for our survival. But in our context where we have choice, I would like to move a bit further than it's up to everybody what they do. You know, that in some ways we have to say it's more like slavery, that benign slavery, having zoos, treating your dog well, is still a form of slavery, and as is high welfare, food for consumption, and not forgetting wool, fur, angora, animal medical testing, as well as what we eat, and that somehow that exploitation needs to be a goal that we, you know, we say is not acceptable. So it's moving from welfare to rights, and I feel that's where we need to be looking.
So yeah, that's a useful question, isn't it? So what about the wider context of this? Is it is this just what we eat, or is it our relationship with animals more fundamentally in terms of exploitation?
So so two aspects to that. One is that our relationships to animals are much wider, as you note, than just our use of animals for food. So in On Animals Volume 2, I talk not just about our use of animals for food, but for textiles, as you mentioned, for research experimentation, for labour, for sport and entertainment, research experimentation, as pets and companion animals, and our impacts on wild animals. And we need to be attentive across that breadth. I think within all of that, I think focusing on food is a really good idea, not just because of the scale and immensity in terms of the numbers of animals and the impacts that has on wild animals, but also it's an issue that we can act on ourselves. It's a part of our everyday Christian practice of eating. You know, we might want to engage with experimentation by, you know, signing a petition to try and improve conditions of lab animal use or eliminate it. But eating is something we can do immediately. And so that seems to me a really important starting place to think about our own practice, which again seems consonant with Jesus' teaching about avoiding hypocrisy. So attending to the log in our own eyes before we be concerned about the specks in other people's. Your point about abolition rather than reform, I think, is a, you know, constant challenge. Obviously, this is a ongoing debate within the animals movement about the best way we can engage with practice. I want to try and have it both ways. I want to both try and encourage people to see ways of thinking of liberative practices in relation to animals, so finding ways to make choices other than eating animals. But I also want to engage with the world as we find it. So I don't think I'm going to be successful in eliminating animal agriculture tomorrow or next week or next year. And for that reason, alongside advocating for eliminating or reducing consumption, I want to advocate for improved rearing of farmed animals, because there are still going to be animals, unfortunately, raised next year and in 2 years and 3 years' time. So for me as a vegan, I want to both make the case to fellow Christians for thinking in that way, but also be trying to work for the well-being of the animals we still have to do with in those ways.
Why do you think it is that so many vegans will eat a vegan beef burger?
Well, it depends on your motivation for being vegan, right? So if you're vegan because you don't like the taste of meat, then the more plant-based meat alternatives become like meat, the worse it is, right? And the more off-putting it is. But I know plenty of vegans who always liked the taste of meat, but just didn't like the fact that this was the bodies of animals who had been badly treated.
Or like the shape of a sausage.
Exactly, yeah. won't go too far with that, Steve.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's a serious point underneath it all, isn't there? So shouldn't we be trying to migrate people away from that invitation?
Well, I don't have a big problem. If people like sausages and burgers, and we can produce really excellently tasty sausages and burgers that taste like the animal products they're replacing, but don't involve all the cruelty and suffering and killing of those animal products, I think I'm absolutely enthusiastic for those. For me, I still taste some of these meat-based burgers and I wince a bit, but I'm absolutely affirming of putting all of those products on the market to reduce the obstacles to people making dietary changes.
Great. This lady down the front, and then somebody way back there.
Hi. I'm assuming that the comment that was just about was about one of the things that's happening right now in the EU, the idea of them making it so that you can't call things vegan burgers and vegan sausages. that whole thing to me is insane, because the animals don't look like that. Like, that's, they don't come out burger shaped or sausage shaped. That's not what they look like. We add plants to their meat to produce those products. So why would we not be allowed to keep the name, because it's not their name? Like, I'd get it if it's like, you know, we're trying to call something like a chicken drumstick or something, but that's not what we're doing. And it just seems ridiculous that this has become a sticking point for some people, and it feels very much like they are completely missing the point.
So how do you communicate your message clearly? Because these things always do become sticking points, don't they? Not just to do with this issue, but so many issues that I can think that I'm involved in. Half the people don't get the point because they get confused by another point.
So the product labeling stuff, I think, is interesting. Again, it seems really silly to me that legislators are trying to pass rules against calling alternatives to meat by obvious names that make sense. But this looks to me like the throes of an animal agriculture industry that's really seriously anxious about the significant rise in eating of plant-based products. I mean, it doesn't seem to me an obviously promising strategy for combating this. It doesn't seem to me that people are going to be off-put by the names of these products. But I think it's a silly...
So let's keep going. There's two questions there.
About what you said before, about the shape of a burger, the shape of a hot dog, why is it still the same? Because vegans don't want to be reminded of that. You know, your question that you posed before. Actually, I can maybe add to that. I've got my son. He's younger. And he's curious. What does the beef burger taste like? What does that taste like? All his friends have bacon. He doesn't even know what it tastes like. And I grew up in that thing when I had meat as a younger person, adopted to becoming a vegan later in life. So actually, that thing where you've got imitation bacon, imitation sausages, actually I see it as a really good thing. Now my son can have imitation bacon and he kind of gets the gist of what it's like. He feels that he's actually taken part in that peer pressure thing, and he won't grow up when he's like later in life think, I want to try a Big Mac, because he's already tried burger and he's tried all the imitation stuff. So I think it really helps people think that they don't need to have that meat. I've seen so many vegans or vegetarian children grow up and sneakily get something on the side. So I think this really helps.
Yeah, that's really, there's a lady next to you. Is it yours a different question?
Yes, it is. I was wondering if there's a level...
Good point, by the way. Sorry.
I was wondering if there's a level of animal welfare that might make it appropriate to eat meat. And I'm thinking of, for example, organic cows that have 3.5 years outside. They wouldn't otherwise exist. And the degree of animal welfare is pretty high. Is there a level that you would see appropriate for meat eating? And what would you think of, for example, in Scotland, there are quotas for the culling of deer in the interests of their welfare, and eating them subsequently would seem to be the best use of that meat? Mm.
And that's a good question, David, and that's been asked several times in different ways. Someone says here, bigger question, so forgive me if this is yours, but it comes down to, in the end, were you saying earlier, you know, Jesus ate different kind of fish to the fish we eat, you know, it wasn't factory farmed lamb, whatever, and were you saying that we should only eat happy animals? Mm-hmm. Same question, put differently.
So the criteria for me, from a Christian understanding, is the extent to which these fellow creatures of the God that we worship have the opportunities to flourish as creatures of God. So glorify God in their flourishing as creatures. The chickens in those broiler sheds, it seems to me, obviously are living sort of non-lives, lives of appalling cruelty. I think if we think of beef cattle grazed in pasture in the UK, I think that that is a different prospect. And I think we need to be prepared to be making qualitative evaluations of differences in the way in which different animals are raised. But there are problems even with these higher welfare certifications. So one thing that really strikes me is, you know, Jesus talks about, he looks on Jerusalem and weeps and said, how much have I longed to gather you up like a mother hen gathers her chicks. And when I last looked around an organic, you know, soil association certified organic chicken farm, you know, the adult chickens were, you know, walking around on grass, you know, with beautiful views of Devon Hills, but there was no maternal care. Either given or received, and chickens pass on considerable things to their chicks, you know, through that maternal relationship, sort of understanding of the world around them. And so it seems to me that even the highest welfare certifications that we have at the moment still are neglectful of key aspects of what it might mean to flourish as a creature of God. So is it better that you're consuming an animal that's had that been raised extensively in the outdoor? Absolutely, than the broiler chicken. But how good is good enough? It's going to be a question for each of us.
Yeah, and so someone makes that exactly that point, David, in a different way. They say, I think you made a conclusive case for Christians reducing meat consumption, not for being vegan. Should Christians not only reduce consumption, are you preaching veganism or not? Mm-hmm. Are you a compromiser? That's what it's saying.
Okay, so you've heard me say, what I'm not saying is that throughout the whole history of the church and for every Christian today, veganism, it's either veganism or damnation, right? So I'm not saying that, okay? So what I'm saying is the really important thing is we get that concern about animals is a Christian concern, that we need to take this seriously. We need to recognize these are animals that are our fellow creatures, the God that we worship. God loves them all into being and cares about them all. And then we need to think about what it means to respond in our context to that. To me, in my context, for my practice, it seems veganism is an obvious step I can take. I have Christian friends who raise farmed animals to high welfare standards and see this as part of their stewardship of the land, care for the land, do care for the animals in their care as best they can. To be honest, I don't want to spend my time arguing with them. What I would like to make common cause with is for vegans and high welfare farmers to together make an alliance challenging the problems of industrial animal agriculture. That seems to me the key, the extremity of the wrongness of what we're doing to animals at the moment. That's what I'd really like to focus our attention to. And so that's why I'm directing our attention to taking decisions to reduce consumption and for animals still being consumed, raising welfare.
The lady at the back.
Hello. My question is, so Proverbs 31:8, one of my favorite Bible verses says, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, ensure justice for those being crushed. And I think I see this as a social justice, but not necessarily just that. So I see it as pro-life, speaking of on behalf of unborn babies, but also of animals because they cannot speak. My question is, how can we as Christian vegans speak up on behalf of animals? I strongly believe, you know, that God loves all animals. You know, you said it, God feeds the sparrow. So if he feeds the sparrow, obviously he cares for the cows and the pigs and the billions of animals who are tortured. So how can we, activism, what's the limit? What should we do about it?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And can I ally it to this one? Because I think it doesn't take away from the power of your question, but it says, how can you convince a parish into a plant-based diet? In other words, how do we take that justice message and actually apply it? Because everybody's enthusiastic here. So how does this work in a local church?
Thank you. I think this is a really, really important question. I meet lots of angry Christian vegans that are either no longer going to church or feel at a great distance from their church communities because of their difficulty of engaging with a community that doesn't see things in quite the same way as we do. And so I think as Christian vegans who want to be advocates for change in churches need to be showing virtues of patience and humility. I think we need to be patient because we need to recognize that other Christians see some other ethical issues more clearly than we do. Okay, so we have a charism or a gift to recognize the particular wrong that's being done in relation to animals in their consumption for food and in other ways. We need to be attentive and patient with people who don't quite see that yet in the same way we do, but maybe have a better grip on the problems of modern slavery or the way in which our textiles are produced in ways that don't show sufficient respect for human workers, or the problems of racism or gender discrimination in the churches. And so I think we need to be listening hard for the things that we don't yet hear as well as others, and be prepared to be in gentle and patient conversation with others who don't yet see the animals thing in the same way as we do. And that connects, so that's, but that I really recognize that demands patience, because when something seems so clear to us in relation to action on this issue, it can be hard to understand why other people aren't prepared to change quickly. So we need to be patient and we need to be humble. And that most those may seem odd virtues to celebrate in terms of activism, but I think what's gone wrong with some animals' activism generally, and especially in relation to Christians, is that lack of patience and a lack of humility has just triggered a set of defensive reactions where people have tried, instead of listening, they've tried to sort of justify their kind of the status quo. And so I think we need to find ways of opening up conversations. CreatureKind, BeCreatureKind.org has a great course on Christianity and animals that you could run at a local church to get people thinking about where animals belong in Christian faith. And so that could be a really good way of just opening up rather than closing down conversations.
Ladies and gentlemen, this isn't the end of the evening, but it is our moment to say thank you to you, David. Thanks for the, for me, really stimulating for me. I've got some ideas and things that I'd like to discuss with Daryl because of it. Thank you very much. Let's give David a round of applause.